colleagues, I just want to let you know there's been an update, and for folks out in the audience, we will not be hearing House Bill 2187 today. That'll be moved over for next week's calendar, hopefully Monday or Wednesday. But we will be hearing House Bill 2101 after the informational meeting on the Deschutes Basin User Group. So with that, I'm going to open up the informational meeting and welcome, gentlemen. It's great to see everybody again. Thanks for coming. And I don't know if you want to introduce your
Him do the introductions. I'm kind of losing my voice.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Neil Bryant. I'm an attorney in Bend, Oregon, where I practiced law for 34 years. And for 8 years, I had the privilege of serving in the Senate. And in 1995, I was on the Water and Land Use Committee for the Senate, where we passed about 40 bills dealing with water. And one of those was Senate Bill 1033. That is the mother of what we're talking about today in the way of mitigation and restoration in the Deschutes Basin. Also, I was involved last session in the bill that codified the mitigation rules, and I'm happy to report we're not asking for any new legislation. This is just a report. But it's a good report. You're going to hear about cooperation and success among the water users in the community, and that it's making a difference in stream restoration and all the other goals that are important to our community. We think that the Deschutes River and the basin is a unique basin. It starts in the forest and kind of a rainforest and snow, and then it goes through a desert. Not many places have that quality. And as you know, it's a wonderful place to live and to recreate. Today, to present this report, we have from the city of Bend, although he's not going to speak, Patrick Griffin, who's prepared the PowerPoint. Of course, city of Bend is very important on the municipal water and the growth that they've had there. We'll have Todd Heisler from the Deschutes River Conservancy, and we'll talk about the mitigation programs and what has happened. We'll have from the irrigation districts and from the Deschutes Water Alliance, Steve Johnson. He's the executive director of Central Oregon Irrigation District. And we'll have Jan Wick, who is president and owner of Avion Water in Bend, which has over 12,000 hookups. And so another large municipal water user. They're a private company, but they're regulated by the PUC. And then also accompanying us today, we have Rex Barber Jr., who is a farmer in Deschutes County, owns Big Falls Ranch, which is along the Deschutes. And if you have questions on impact on agriculture or how to lose money in agriculture, Rex can explain that to you. But with that, I'll step aside and allow the others to present the PowerPoint, and I have copies of their presentation.
Thank you. I was going to say that you shouldn't have said 40 bills because you're setting a very high bar for this committee.
The farmer was in trouble when we did
that. Welcome, gentlemen. It's good to see you back.
Thank you.
Thanks. Madam Chair, representatives, thank you for having us here to give you this briefing. I think on the Deschutes Basin. I'm sure you hear a lot about conflict and controversy over water, but we're here to tell you a story of collaboration and cooperation. And introduction.
Thank you.
My name is Todd Heisler. I'm the executive director of the Deschutes River Conservancy, and I'm a member of the Deschutes Water Alliance. So again, what we'd like to do is tell you what's working in the Deschutes Basin and how important this alliance is to water management in our basin. 3 years ago, we got really the largest suppliers and demanders of water in the basin together in an alliance. All 8 irrigation districts, the Deschutes Basin Board of Control, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, the Deschutes River Conservancy, and the Central Oregon Cities Organization, which was primarily represented by Bend and Redmond at that time. So we came together to see how can we balance water uses for agriculture, cities, and rivers in the basin. Is there a way for us to instead of be competing demands for water, to actually cooperate and help each other achieve our needs for water? So one of the compelling and driving trends in the basin that galvanized the group was the issues around the river. And I think everybody understood the problems with the river. Here you'll see the blue whale. You've got the natural flow at the top, summer flow, and winter flow. Now, it's a very unique basin here because you can see that the natural flow all the way down to Lake Billy Chinook is a fairly narrow line. And then you get a very large wedge of water down at the bottom that flows all the way into the Columbia River. And that shows the amazing groundwater aquifer that is recharged in the Cascades and discharges there at the fat part of that whale. The way to read this is the thickness of the blue line, of course, is the amount of water in the stream at that point. So in the summer, the average summer flows, you'll see a major hole. This is because irrigation traditionally diverted about 98% of the water in Bend and caused a disruption of flow in the summer months. Everybody recognized this issue and really all come together to figure out how can we cooperatively solve this problem. In the winter, while we're storing water in Wickiup Reservoir, we also have an issue from Wickiup down to Fall River, about 25 miles of the stream.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Representative Burley.
Todd, sorry to interrupt you, but
sure.
For some folks that aren't familiar with the basin, would you please point to where some of those areas, so we get a reference where
okay.
Bend is, for
Let's
example,
see.
And
can I?
Wickiup and...
The only thing is we need you to be at the... or somebody to be at the mic. Yeah, Patrick will point, because we have to have you on record here.
Okay, let's start at let's just go to summer flow and start. Let's take it all the way from the top. So, can you point out where Wickiup Reservoir is? Okay, those are the reservoirs, but Wickiup in particular is right there, and then you move down to Bend, come all the way down to Bend. Okay, and then down to Lake Billy Chinook, and then the lower river below the Pelton Round Butte hydroelectric facility.
And the main rivers there are the Crooked coming in here, the Metolius Farm, okay, shown up there better, and then the groundwater discharge that comes out right at that confluence area.
And then, so in the wintertime at the bottom, you can see the dams are in the black lines, and you can see a very, very thin line below the black line to the right, which represents pretty much of a dewatered river in the winter months. So we have seasonal, large disruption of flow. And all the alliance members came around the table and said, how can we meet our own water needs and address this problem in the river at the same time in a cooperative way? So the first thing we did as an alliance was say, well, we need to have, what are our common goals? And everybody agreed that we want to move stream flows towards a more natural hydrograph while securing and maintaining improved in-stream flows and water quality to support fish and wildlife. We also wanted to secure and maintain a reliable and affordable water supply to sustain agriculture and secure safe, affordable, and high-quality water to supply for urban communities. And our initial understanding of water in the basin led us to believe that, in fact, it was possible to meet all these goals simultaneously. And so each of the alliance members was asked to hold all three goals, not just the goal that applied to their set of stakeholders, but to really hold all three of them as their own goals. And so in that way, we build trust among the group. Using Department of Interior Water 2025 funding, we did a number of studies and pilot projects. Essentially, those studies were to assess what is the true demand for water in the basin and what is the supply. And we were most interested in understanding the new demand for water. If cities have new demand, what is it? If the river has in-stream water rights, as demonstrated by those whales that aren't being fulfilled, how much water is that? If there are junior agricultural users who aren't getting their full water rights, how much water is that? And if there are resorts cropping up here and there throughout the Tri-County area, what kind of water will they need? And so this is not demand for all water in the basin, but this is for the new water, the water for redistribution. So you can see the pie chart on the right essentially 76% of the new demand for water is for those in-stream water rights. The municipalities who get all the headlines about water actually have a demand, and here it was only 2% of the need, and the resorts another 9%. And then agriculture, which is in our basin generally the North Unity Irrigation District, is the junior user of large consequence, and that's about 13% of the new demand. So then we said to ourselves, now that we know what the demand is, how can we actually meet all of those new demands for water? So, well, if we operate our reservoirs differently, if we transfer water off urbanizing acres, those are acres that are already being taken out of agricultural production because of expanding cities in Central Oregon, if we lease water rights in the basin, and if we undertake large-scale conservation initiatives, we have the solution. You can see the bottom half of the chart is three forms of conservation: conservation of laterals, conservation of main canals, and conservation on farm. And it's virtually half the solution. So we really want to point out that conservation of agricultural water is the single most important thing in our basin to achieve all of the objectives for the cities, the stream, and the districts.
Can I interrupt you for a question here, which is on the conservation of the main canals? First of all, two questions. One, was that lining? Did you pipe it? Was it looking at leakage mainly? And then two, what was the source of funding? Was that ratepayer? Or did you get special grants to do that?
So we are still in the process of implementing those conservation projects. We look primarily at piping the canals because there's a 50% transmission loss, seepage loss, in many of those canals right near Bend. So you essentially double your water if you put the water in a pipe. We are planning to finance those from really federal, state, and hydro mitigation revenues, both from Bonneville Power and PGE and the tribes. Those would be the four major sources of public-private funding for it, and then a bunch of other smaller sources, but that would dominate the picture for that. We think there's probably $100 million of these projects over the next decade to be performed, and the lion's share of the permanent new in-stream water rights that we would create in the basin for in-stream flow would come from these projects.
And one final question is, are all of the irrigation districts that are involved with this participating?
Virtually, yes, all the irrigation districts, probably except for Arnold's the only irrigation district of the eight that we haven't done probably much more than lease water, but they're all participating in some way. They have a problem with the flume that doesn't allow for a major conservation project, but all of the others have conservation projects in the queue.
Okay, great, thank you.
Okay, So we looked at the supply and demand, and then we went back to assess the public goals that we were trying to meet, river restoration being one, domestic water supply, and maintaining agricultural lands. And we said, which of the solutions that we just talked about are most appropriate for this, to serve this public goal, to meet these public goals? And as I just expressed, conservation of agricultural water is the single biggest thing for river restoration, as well as the leasing program. There will be some restoration benefit from the mitigation program and from transferring urbanized water acres back in stream, but the two primary and dominant ones for river restoration will be conservation and leasing. To meet the growing city's needs, water banking, that's transferring those urbanizing agricultural acres in stream and getting mitigation credits for new groundwater permits. And all of these have been looked at in terms of how they affect agricultural lands, and they all compensate or benefit the irrigation districts. So just so you get an idea of what kind of progress we have been making in a very short amount of time, 5 years, we've already produced 100 CFS from the leasing program alone. It's a very popular program. It's probably the hallmark program of the Deschutes River Conservancy, and we expect it to continue to grow. The leasing program, of course, is a temporary form of river restoration. And ultimately, we would like to see permanent in-stream water rights created, and the best way to do that is through water conservation. And it started slow, but you can see we're seeing dramatic growth in that. And given that all the irrigation districts, really except one, want to participate in this program, we expect this chart really to be very impressive in the next over the next few years, over the next decade. So If you take all of the ways in which we're providing in-stream flow restoration and look at the Deschutes River in particular, we work on the Deschutes River and all its tributaries, but here's an example of what's happening on the Deschutes. The gray section of the chart shows a gentleman's agreement among the irrigation districts for the first 30 CFS of in-stream flow. The blue is a pure, what we call pure restoration. That would be leasing, water conservation, and transfers. And then you can see the restoration impact of the mitigation program, which is the little green at the top. So the point is that above the Pelton Round Butte complex, the mitigation program has a restorative benefit to the river. It's actually relatively small. It's dwarfed in comparison to all of the other things that we're doing, but it is important, and it's part of the overall effort to restore the flows in the Deschutes.
But can you explain what the gentleman's agreement?
The gentleman's agreement is literally what it sounds like, not a contractual but a voluntary agreement among the districts to not take all the water out of the river. They have the right to drain the river, and they agree to leave at least 30 in, and then we've been building on top of that voluntary agreement by the irrigation districts.
Question,
Representative Early.
Madam Chair, Todd, what's the target for this stretch of the river? Because I think it's important to show how quickly we're moving
question.
Towards that.
Yes, so they, in 2006 we hit the 100 CFS milestone. The goal is 250 CFS. We believe that is sufficient to provide the proper stream function in that. But we, of course, as we get closer to that target, we'll be monitoring it to assure. But currently our target is, and that we expect it to hold, is 250 CFS. A lot of the restoration to date has been leasing, in the form of leasing, which is temporary. So we'd like to see more permanent flow restoration as part of that. But leasing will always be in the mix, always be a part of the solution in the Deschutes.
Well, I have a question, a follow-up question to this point. As far as leasing, as development pressures, I mean, we know Deschutes is one of the fastest growing counties in the state, and as development pressures increase, and there's not a lot of new water, so, you know, looking at agricultural water for growth certainly is where most people are, or a lot of folks are looking at, and wanted to see so what, you know, what you are doing to look at making those agreements more permanent, because that's going to be the place, I think, where there's the greatest potential for impact. I mean, there's not a lot of, there's no new water.
Right.
Unless, you know, right, folks are looking at exempt groundwater wells, which I, that's another mm-hmm. question I have for you. But can you maybe talk a little bit about that and the attempt to make these leases more permanent?
Yes. We think the biggest way in which we will create permanent in-stream water rights is through conservation, is through the piping and lining of the canals. That's the win-win scenario of a scale, of a large scale, that we have agreement with the districts and the conservation community to actually implement. There, of course, as urbanization occurs, you're right, there's growth occurring, there's subdivisions that are occurring on irrigated agricultural land, and as the water comes off of those lands, we're seeing that first as a source of water for those growing cities. Retire the surface rights, use that as the form of mitigation, generate the credits for the cities of Bend and Redmond. There, of course, will be an increment of water above the needs of the cities that could be purchased by conservation buyers and others to create permanent in-stream rights from that very in that very same way. So we will see a small amount of permanent transfers of agricultural rights, but I don't expect it to be the dominant force. I still believe that it's going to be a combination of leasing and conservation, which is what will amount to the majority of restoration in the basin.
Representative Burley has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Todd, this is something I guess I've never really quite had straight in my mind, but isn't there a multiplier effect when you urbanize agricultural surface water right to a municipal right? And is that a beneficial thing in that it provides for more opportunity for conservation?
It does provide more opportunity for restoration in the river. So, for example, it all depends what you're growing on the land, but let's say you're growing alfalfa and then you turn it into a subdivision. On average, I know Patrick and I go back and forth on what these numbers are, but it's a minimum of 1 to 5 difference. That is that the alfalfa would be 5 times as water intensive, and some say as much as 10 times as water intensive, depending on lots of other factors. But it's going to be somewhere in that realm. So therefore, you generate a surplus of water every time you take that out for an urbanized purpose.
And a follow-up is, so what typically happens to that? Is it going back in stream? Is that then up for other development? I mean,
well, Steve will talk in a minute about the Central Oregon Water Bank, and that is the facility we've created to try to come up with a collaborative way to reallocate the resource. So, sure, some of it will end up restored in the river because the DRC will be there to purchase it as a conservation buyer. Some might go back on the land. Some might go to the city. So that's a good question, and he'll get into that in more detail, but we have a facility to do that reallocation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will pass the baton to my colleague, Steve Johnson.
Thank you. Steve Johnson, I'm the manager of Central Oregon Irrigation District in Redmond, Oregon. From the pie chart that Todd had up earlier, we had the sources of supply, and there were multiple pieces of that pie. Not quite 25% over the next 20 years of allocation is going to be done through transfers. And so, as some of you may well know, the transfer process can be complicated, particularly if it's people that have new demands for water that haven't participated in the process with the department before, et cetera. And it's somewhat complicated and to a certain extent for a layman, not understandable. So one of the mechanisms that we've perfected, and this was part of the Water 2025 grant we got from the Department of Interior, and since then we've gotten a standalone grant, one of only one out of 10. We were the first one awarded last year out of 10 total for the entire western United States. So Bureau of Reclamation wants to see us succeed with this bank as well as we do. But it's a way, it's a cooperative bank, it's purely voluntary, nonprofit, where the urbanizing acres we foresee as the primary supply of being available to move from the traditional use of hay or alfalfa irrigation over to the municipal use. And we're creating what we call it the Central Oregon Water Bank, or the CAL Bank, and Todd will take credit for the acronym. But it's important to understand that what we're talking about here, beside it being voluntary and nonprofit, is that we're talking about permanent water transfers. The districts that participate and are members of this bank fully understand that this is permanent removal from their certificates and that it will be moving to a new use. Now, part of the bank structure, though, provides for the financial sustainability for the irrigation districts. It's kind of like your tax base. If your acres of water right move off your certificate, you have a lower base for assessment. And so that was a concern. And what we've been able to do is implement, and the buyers here represented, at this point in time, cities of Bend, Redmond, and the Avion Water Company, and Jan will be talking a little bit right after I am, they're agreeing to pay what's called an exit fee, which takes care of a permanent situation for the lost assessment. So basically a principal payment to release them entirely from any assessment obligations in the future. So we see that as a sustainability factor that's very favorable. So it's in the district's interest when we are being urbanized, we do not have new farm ground that's asking for demand for the water. And so we see this as a good process that's beneficial, or you might say make as much lemonade out of a lemon situation as you can. An important aspect of this also is that it's supply and demand driven. We had 20 years worth of projections up there in the pie chart. Urbanization will have accelerated growth and accelerated back off over time, but it's foreseen over the next 20 to 50 years that the amount of urbanization will, and the transfer of these water rights, will satisfy municipal demand.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
And I know that this has been an issue. I mean, it's as far as the viability of the irrigation district, you've got to have enough of a base to pay off your debt service and
right.
You know, all in making sure that you can pay both your principal and interest. The question is, I mean, I guess as a district, you have to say that at some point, I mean, unless you're going to completely dissolve, pay off all your debts? I mean, do you have sort of a threshold or something that you say, okay, we can't go below this amount because we're not going to be able to pay off our existing debt, or you're able to figure that out in the cost when you're assessing that fee to the municipalities?
Yeah, there's two components to what we call our exit fee, and one of them is if you took our O&M budget for the year for 2007, let's say it's $2 million, and it's not quite 50,000 acres we have in assessment, but to make the math easy, you take $2 million, divide by 50,000, you have $40, okay? That $40 represents an interest amount that we need off of an amount of principal so that you can invest, let's say it's $1,000 and you get a 4% return, then you're going to get $40 to replace the assessment that's gone. So that's how we calculate the first part of the exit fee. The second part, though, is the debt. Any debt that we have in principal, we take that and divide by the numbers of acres that are under assessment. Now, there potentially is an operational limit that you get to. Within COID, with 45,000 acres under assessment, it's not foreseen, even with the large amount of urbanization that's it's projected to be about 7,000 to 8,000 acres over the next 20-so years. Approximately 5,000 of that will be out of COID. So we're looking at maybe 12%. So at this point, 20 years forward, if those numbers hold, we're not foreseeing an operational problem. That doesn't mean that it can't exist in a particular stretch of the district where water rights want to be removed from, say, a smaller lateral. And we evaluate that, though. When we look at the water rights that I'll show in a graphic how we process the water rights that from willing sellers, the district buys those. And when we allocate that water to the municipals, we identify specific water rights that move that way. So we retain in reserve, right now at this point, it's over 200 acres of water right that we're reserving for on the ground surface irrigation use. And so where we have a critical water right that's being sold to the district from a stretch of the ditch, then we keep that in the reserves. If I may, did I answer your question fine? Okay. The process with the bank itself, we try to keep it as simple as possible. As you can understand, when you have a lot of parties in the room, it's difficult sometimes to get consensus, so keeping it simple, or the KISS principle, is what we try to enact. There are specific targets of supply and specific targets of demand that we go through in what we call bank committee process, and that's cities of Bend and Redmond, as I mentioned, along with Avion, what are their demands on average per year with their existing permits, what their forecasted demand is. It's not hypothetical. We get it defined as well as possible. And we look at the urbanizing trend. We already know what plats have been submitted for the foreseeable year, as well as what the volume of water right transactions we have within the district. And that balances so far the last 2 years. So targets are established. My board officially recognizes those targets and what percentage of the targets COID believes it can fulfill. And along with the Swale Irrigation District Board, they go through the same process. And it's recognized that those areas of the district basically are urbanized now, and it's not for irrigated agriculture. And it's looked at as a positive aspect of trying to stay financially sustainable. That's part of the trade-off.
Steve, have you looked at or tried to assess what you think the impacts of Measure 37 is going to be on your districts for water availability?
Yeah, for the way I'll answer that, Madam Chair, is that in Deschutes, we operate in three counties. So I can only speak to Central Oregon Irrigation District specifically, in that there's over 2,000 acres of water right that will be impacted in Deschutes County with filed Measure 37 claims, and nearly 1,700 acres in Crook County on Measure 37 claims. Now, with the plans that I have seen to date, approximately 50 to 40% of that amount of water will be retained on the ground where it is now. So looking for, let's say conservatively, 40% of that needing to move because there'll be a house, a driveway, a road, what have you, on top of that. So development overall, whether it's a Measure 37 or a UGB expansion, will be a significant amount for COI. we're fortunate in that we're large enough. I believe we can handle that at this time. But that's where the important part of the conserved water projects come in. If everything is just going out of the district and we aren't improving our ability to deliver to the patrons, then we're not going to be able to let anything out. So it's somewhat of a circle of relationship, in that if we don't improve and make our systems more efficient, we won't be able to deliver to the last guy at the ditch, you know, 20 or 30 years from now. So this graphic that's up in front here just illustrates the process that we go through. The unallocated bank reserves on the lower left, that is basically the collection bin of the water rights that are available on the market. And these are willing sellers. Primarily, most of this comes from developized or developed acreage, or a subdivision is going to be placed. The district acquires that water right. We try to meet our surface reserve requirements first, and then we'll have what's called unallocated reserves. And that's where it'll move to either muni buyer, restoration for the stream, and for the groundwater bank. And the groundwater bank is a state-chartered function that the DRC has in what's called the Deschutes Water Exchange. That's where the temporary credits are being utilized for mitigation, primarily for private landowners. And this is their access to the bank, but their ultimate desire is permanent credits versus temporary. And so they fulfill a function as well. So you have the muni as well as the groundwater bank desire for permanent credits, but there's restoration also. Just to give you a scale of activity, in 2006, there were 366 acres moved through Swally and COID to the bank. 75 acres was targeted for restoration, only 55 for groundwater mitigation, and 89 for municipal. Our targets in 2007 are for 70 acres for restoration, 25 for the groundwater mitigation bank, and approximately 195 for City of Bend, Redmond, and for Avion. The next area that's going to be annexed into the Redmond UGB that was approved by LUBA in December is 440 acres. Approximately 420 of that's water rights. So urbanizing acres is fulfilling that demand at this time. And the last thing to mention is that, please advance the slide, Ty, is that I would tell you that collaboration works. If we didn't have the relationships that you saw earlier that Todd presented of the tribes, the cities, cooperation with Avion, the Deschutes River Conservancy, and the irrigation districts, this wouldn't work. So, because the water, the traditional uses for the water is just changing, whether it's land use driven or value driven by the people that occupy the land now. I would tell you that the mitigation program is working, that the stakeholders are working together, that we're utilizing the tools that are available to us in statute. We're not trying to come up with new ways to create to come before you. That may be something that happens in the future. That's why we appreciate the opportunity for this session here today, just to have you guys get familiar with our situation. But we're utilizing the tools that are in place, and we believe we're utilizing those effectively. And in-stream flows are increasing, as you saw from the slides earlier, and it's a consensus-driven process. Those are my comments.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead, and then we'll open up for questions for everybody.
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Jan Wick. I'm the president and owner of Avion Water Company. We are not a member of the Deschutes Water Alliance, but we were substantial financial supporters thereof. We funded $14,500 worth of the engineering studies that were done as part of the project. A question that often arises in these arenas is our resorts. My company is providing water to currently five resorts. One of them is an older resort, Pronghorn, that's been started in about 2000. The remainder of those resorts are all water neutral resorts. That is, their irrigation land, croplands are dried up, or water is otherwise mitigated for, but is used in all of those resort projects so that they are in fact water neutral. we do enjoy within our basin a terrific cooperation between a wide variety of interests. I think special consideration needs to be given to agriculture and the water districts. Agricultural interests in the water districts, CLID and Swale have been particularly cooperative, as has the Deschutes River Conservancy. Avian Water Company has developed, along with the Deschutes River Conservancy, a blue water program. We believe this to be the first such program in the United States. Just a couple of months ago, the Oregon Public Utilities Commission approved the program. Essentially, what it boils down to is that our customers will be encouraged by an advertising campaign to start in March to purchase mitigation credits that would mitigate for their entire household's water use by replacing the water that they would, providing funds to the DRC for water that they would normally use in their household for in-streaming of leased water. It's our anticipation that we may be able to put up to 5 cubic feet per second of water in the river at the middle reach of, at the river, the Bend River House, which would add 5% to the flow that we currently are able to put in that reach of the river. A significant amount of water in that location on the river. We had a great deal of help from DRC. To mention a couple of names, Jen Herbert, Jason Wick, is actually related to me. you might say fairly directly. Bruce Aylward put this together along with the Oregon Public Utilities Commission. The cities of Bend and Redmond are currently in negotiations with DRC, the Deschutes River Conservancy, to create similar voluntary programs. If all of the municipalities in the region and Avian Water Company participate together, we can have a significant impact at the River House, and would hope that we do. Do you have any questions?
Actually, I had a quick one for you and then open up for the panel, whole panel here. Do you own your own water rights? I mean, I was curious about that because we don't. We have mostly public water suppliers in our neck of the woods. So do you have a water right? Did you transfer that from?
Actually, we own Avion Water Company Incorporated is a investor-owned, publicly regulated utility mm-hmm. company. And as such, we hold, in the name of Avion Water Company, Inc., substantial water rights. We own approximately enough water rights for 38,000 households, that order of magnitude. And we currently provide water to around 12,000 households.
Okay. And that's in addition to the city of Bend also has municipal water supply.
Yeah, our water rights are actually termed quasi-municipal water rights. That's a legal term that was actually invented, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago to accommodate, and it's embedded in law, to accommodate investor-owned utilities. In the Northwest, it is now uncommon for investor-owned utilities to provide municipal water service. That was not the case as recently as the middle 70s. For instance, Salem's water system used to be owned up until the middle 70s by Pacific Power and Light. Prineville's water system was owned by Pacific Power and Light, as were a large number of other municipal-type supply systems throughout the Northwest. In the middle 70s, most of the power companies, and they were power companies that were involved, sold those water systems to the municipal corporations that they served. We are an exception because essentially Avian Water Company started out as mainly a rural water supplier, and a city grew over the top of us. So we now work actually in fairly close partnership with the city of Bend in that our water systems are intertied to provide mutual support and things like that.
Thank you for the clarification. And I, at some point, I'll talk to the Water Resources Department because I actually don't know how many investor-owned water companies we have in Oregon. I think do you have the answer for that off the top of your head?
Well, I can't give you the I can tell you that the number of regulated utility mm-hmm. companies is very few because the standards for regulation, you have to meet a certain threshold. I think that if all of the investor-owned utility companies' patronage in Oregon were combined, they would not be as large as Avion Water Company. Basically, the largest other investor-owned utility is Sun River, and I think they have 2,500, 2,700 households they serve. Today, we're Avion Water Company is anomalous. We're, you know, I'm glad we are, but we are indeed.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. That's, like, as I said to my committee, in this committee, you learn something new every day about water, no matter how long you work about it. I know it's private water companies are much more prevalent in the East Coast than they are on the West.
It's actually almost a million customers in California are served by California Water and Power. The eastern part of the United States is by and large provided water by investor-owned water utilities. And in the Midwest, the largest water company in the United States, I think, has in Missouri, Iowa, that sort of thing, 3 or 4 million service connections.
And if I recall right, that was part of Enron's portfolio before they disbanded.
Yeah, you know, I'm one of the good guys.
there was no association whatsoever, but I do know.
We are in legally almost the same as Enron, but we are, in fact, one of the good guys.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, earlier today, when we were walking over to lunch, you asked me a question I'd like to ask Steve to address. What are you and some of the other irrigation districts looking at doing as far as trying to install some small hydro projects as part of this lining and piping effort?
Yeah, one of the. Excuse me. Thank you, Representative Burley, Madam Chair. Todd threw out a number, $100 million something. No matter how many partners we get together, two of the projects that are moving forward right now have the additional benefit of hydro capability. As you may recall, Jan Lee, the manager of Swallow Irrigation District, and myself had testified earlier on Bill 2211, I believe, on the Business Energy Tax Credit. And so there, the pipe has its cost, and the ability to provide funding to pay for the piping, which conserves the water, which goes into the river. In certain places, hydro projects make sense, and those two in particular with Swally and Central Oregon Irrigation District. Not all places of our district can be piped to generate hydro, but it's substantial. The project that we have is 2 miles of pipe with a hydro on the end will generate 20 cubic feet of conserved water to be placed in stream. And approximately 60% of that pipe project and the hydro facility costs may be able to be covered by the hydro revenue itself over the period of time of that project.
Thank you. Representative Cannon, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did. Perhaps. Thank you, Madam Chair.
This is the first time he's seen the blue whale, so he was very excited, especially see that smile on the whale.
I've heard references to it. I had no idea what they were talking about. And maybe the Water Resources Department went over this in an earlier presentation, but if so, I missed it. And that is how you go, what the process is to go from water conservation to an in-stream water right. Is that how exactly does that work? Do you automatically get a water right when you? It's an in-stream water right, but is that automatically created when you conserve, or is that something that's going on, especially in the Deschutes Basin, or is that a big part of state law?
I can speak. Thanks, Representative Kim, Madam Chair. Am I doing that right, by the way? Okay. All right.
Fine.
Sorry. It's Friday, right?
So you didn't call me Mr. Chair or some other representative's name, which just happened earlier this week, but it's okay.
So far, I'm okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Doing
thank
great.
You. The question. Yes. I can tell you from the experience I've had, Central Oregon Irrigation District has done 3 official conserved water projects. And what I mean by that is there's a specific process, an application you file with the Water Resource Department. You identify the quantity of water that you believe you will conserve and also what you intend to do with that water. Now, there is a stipulation, though, that a minimum of 25% has to go in stream. Okay? And if I recall correctly, and if someone here is from the department and I mess up, I apologize. But through that process, the department staff, they evaluate injury just as they do with any other kind of water right change. And if injury is not, if there is no finding of injury, then a certificate is actually awarded for that conserved water for that use that you requested on the application. You have options after that certificate's issued. And I should point out, that's a good question, and we didn't cover that to that level of detail, but the conserved water that we're talking about in Central Oregon to meet the pie chart that we laid out here, one of the options in statute is conserved water for mitigation to then have a subsequent consumptive use of municipal right. That is not in our plans. The conserved water that Todd was talking about, that the districts are talking about, is for in-stream restoration in its entirety.
And we can have, I'd be happy to have the Water Resources Department come up and follow up, because it's, you did an excellent job, and I see the Water Resources Department nodding back there, but there, it is a somewhat complicated part of the law. I do have one last question, and then we'll see if there's any other questions before we bring up the Water Resources Department, and you're welcome to stay for the hearings on their fee bill. We had a lot of discussion about water measurement this past week, as you might have heard, and maybe you can explain as an irrigation district what your obligations are under the law. I think there was a lot of confusion about that, and what your ways that you're using water measurement in your district, or anything you'd like to share on that.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. With Central Oregon Irrigation District, we actually measure the water at three different places. First of all, at the diversion points off of the Deschutes River where we divert. And then we have, so you have your main canal where the water's flowing, and then as it branches out, we call that a lateral. We measure then also at the lateral, and we know how many acres are served from that lateral. And then we have per delivery when it enters onto the farm ground. So we have three points of measurement. And the first one is available and is monitored by the Water Resource Department past that, the state gauge, as we refer to it, on the river. Once it moves into our canal system, then we monitor that. Ditch riders report that, record that. I should add that over the course of time, the number of deliveries in those 45,000 acres I was mentioning to you has proliferated greatly, in excess of 4,000 deliveries now inside Central Oregon Irrigation District. And the measurement that we do is as much as is humanly possible. And we're also implementing technology through telemetry, where we have automatic recording of as many measurements as we can, primarily on the main laterals, as we call them. So we're able to, I call it water area management, where we know how many acres are served off of a lateral. This spring, we will have telemetry information available through handhelds in the cabs for our trucks, as well as back in the office. And we know, and parameters are set on what maximum flows or minimum flows should be there per lateral. So if you have 1,000 acres with the type of duty that we have, we know exactly how many gallons per minute are maximum allowed to flow down that lateral, and that'll be instantaneously reported. So that's the level of measurement, and that's how serious we take it.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel before we let them go? Well, thank you, gentlemen. We really appreciate you being here today. And just to let you know, our committee is planning to hold a field hearing in Bend on March 9th. And we would like to, we're going to be a little bit pressed for time because we have to drive over here, but we would like to try to combine. The purpose of the committee will be focusing on renewable energy, mm-hmm. yet we'd like to see if we can set up a couple of field trips. So there's been a lot of requests to see fish screens.
No, Madam Chair, I have requested to see fish
We've had a lot of
maybe
requests.
Maybe of no interest to anyone else.
No, I think it would be of great interest to many of us. But what we'd like to do is maybe before you leave today, we'll talk with you about the possibility of doing a site visit in close proximity. And that your district is sort of perfect for that because you are pretty close to the city.
And if you don't mind, we could show you our existing hydro facility that's been online since 1989.
Yeah, that's a possibility. So we'll before you leave today, if you can coordinate with us, we'd appreciate it.
And that's right next to a fish screen, too.
So. There you go. Thanks so much. We appreciate you coming over here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm heading your way this afternoon, so I certainly hope there's good snow over there.
There's good snow.
Excellent. As a backcountry skier, that's what I like to hear. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the informational session on the Deschutes Basin Users Group update and open up a work session on House Bill 2101. Beth, do you want to remind us about that bill, and then we will have the Water Resources Department come up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2101 is the bill that you heard on February 14th that would create new fees and increase the amount of certain fees that are collected by the Water Resources Department. You should have in front of you the fiscal statement, and this bill does have a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Okay. Debbie and whoever else wants to come up from the Water Resources Department. After the way we treated Tom last time, I can see why he's sitting outside there. Okay. Do you have anything that you'd like to add? We are in work session now, committee members, so if you have any questions for the department about, should hopefully still have their fee schedule. And then you now have the fiscal analysis from LFO. And just a reminder that this is a referral to Ways and Means, so it will be going to the subcommittee Ways and Means Natural Resources.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department. And unless you had any questions for me, I guess I would just say that at your last hearing, there was some testimony that were pointing to some specifics of the fee bill. And I would just mention that, you know, we can work with the Ways and Means Subcommittee to address any of those concerns, possibly amend it in that process. So I would just kind of mention that to this committee.
No, I appreciate it. And there was we heard from a couple of the witnesses concern about, if I recall, it was the groundwater fees and then the filing of a protest fee. And do you recall, was there other? Those were the two that I...
Madam Chair, the big one was the storage one, I thought.
Right, but I think part
I think
of that
we
was...
Got that, I think we got that cleared up.
Right, I think part of that was a misunderstanding of how that would be applied. Are there any other questions for the department when we have them here? Okay.
Thank you.
With that, I will take a motion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you. I move the adoption of House Bill 2101 with a due pass recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee. And if you have a script, I'll try and get
sure.
it right.
Okay, Representative Cannon did an excellent job, and he moves House Bill 2101. Actually, it's to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill is to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I will be a no vote, but I must say I do appreciate the department's effort to work with me and to walk through this bill with me and to explain the many components of this bill.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? And I too had some concerns about a couple of the fees that I've shared with the department, and since I will be working with them in the Ways and Means Committee, I will be a yes vote on this, but certainly we'll have more discussions in the committee. Okay. With that, those in the opinion of House Bill 2101 should be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The bill will be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Will vote aye. Those opposed, vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Representative Jensen?
Mm-hmm. With reservation.
I take that as an aye with reservation?
That's okay. True.
Representative Burley?
Aye. Excuse me, aye.
Representative Cannon?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Is excused.
Chair Dingfeld?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion having received required majority is declared passed. And we don't need a carrier because it's going to Ways and Means, correct? Okay. So with that, we're actually going to close the committee since our other bill is not ready. Close the House Committee on Energy and Environment, and I hope everyone...